Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. It's 9:06. KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW and KUOW.org, I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scherr's on sabbatical till October. Coming up on Weekday this morning, we're going to hear a physician and ethicist's thoughts on the best way to die, that conversation in the 10 o'clock hour. We're also going to talk with some folks who are at the other end of their lifespan, three high school freshmen, talk about their 10-year-long musical collaboration. Sometimes some of the best-intentioned ideas go awry, and that happened last week to Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn. The mayor announced a lovely plan to turn a cache of guns into public art, advocating for nonviolence and peace. Instead, the proposal blew apart when it turned out the police department had already melted the guns into rebar. Seattle Mayor McGinn is with us once again to talk about this and other issues that face the city of Seattle. Hello, and we're just going to start with the hot potato.
Now that really is a little bit of this is NPR. That was really quite a bit of hyperbole there in that intro.
Purple prose. I'm curious who first came up with that idea of taking the guns from the gun buyback and making them into art.
So, and before we get to that, I do want to say we have a second buyback scheduled. And
when is that?
It will be this summer. We don't have a specific date. But it will be this summer, and we will use those guns for this purpose. So I don't think the whole idea blew up. In fact, it's still proceeding. We're moving forward. And it's really great because it gives kids, we can have a conversation with our kids who want to have that conversation, and they can enjoy it. I think it was an idea. It's hard to say exactly who came up with it because I think it was an idea that was floating around. It's something that other cities have done with gun buybacks in some way, try to the gun buyback is in many ways, get some more symbolism, meaningful symbolism out of it. And it makes a difference. People really care about making something out of this.
It was more than 20 years ago, 92, the city had a gun buyback program. And I believe that those guns were intended for a sculpture. And I'm not sure if that ever happened either.
I don't know.
Well, so I guess I want to go back to the folks who organized the gun buyback, who I think were the police department, took these guns, and then where did the guns go?
Well, they ended up being sent over to Nucor, where they were turned into some rebar, which my understanding is were actually used in community buildings. But we had thought that they'd been hanging on to them for the artwork. We learned that morning that that wasn't the case. But again, we had another gun buyback on the books for later in the summer. So we thought that it was still a perfectly valid program.
So I thought that they kept those guns in some sort of vault in the police department with other confiscated weaponry. That's not how it works?
Basically, but they had, as I said, turned over the first batch, most of the first batch. And so what we're looking now at is we have a gun buyback scheduled in the summer, and the program can still go ahead. And I know the media loves the little aspect of this that, it's not the guns from the first buyback, it's from the second one, and when did you know? We've got our own little interesting little thing going on here. But let's not let it detract from the value of the program or the generosity of Dale and Leslie Shahuli or Schnitzer Steele, who are going to work on this, or the meaning of this to make these plaques out of it.
So there was money left over from the first buyback for the second buyback?
We have about $50,000 in hand. So when we first raised money, that we had a certain amount of money on hand at the first buyback and pretty much used it up. But we had further pledges, which we've since collected. So we have enough money. We'd love a little more. We'd love some more support for the second one.
So essentially, the gun owners who turn their guns in are going to get, they're not getting cash. They're getting scrip of some sort, right?
Amazon gift cards is what we were using.
Okay.
That's right.
Generic. I use the generic word script. Amazon gift cards. And then this time, people are going to keep track of these guns so that you know where they go?
They were keeping track of them last time, but I think they'll be a little closer track this time. I think it's fair to say that. Yeah.
So we're just out of curiosity. Last week, one of our journalist panel members, Knut Berger of Crosscut, said he thought it was appropriate for a mayor under whom a lot of development has gone on that the guns actually be turned into rebar instead of art. But do you have any idea where that rebar went?
My understanding, and now I'm hesitant, but what I was told that morning was that they were in fact used in community buildings of some type. I don't know exactly where they went.
On a bigger question about gun buybacks in general, the state legislature, the U.S. Congress, everybody's debating sort of how do we deal with the issue of gun violence and what really is effective. Do you have any hard numbers that gun buyback programs really do deter future gun violence?
You know, some hard data. I think it's in the order of 25, you know, over the last decade or so, something like 2,500 guns have been stolen out of people's homes. And so they then enter, you know, the commerce, and seeing as it was stolen, it's probably being traded around amongst criminals in the first place. Maybe they're sold back to responsible gun owners after that. I don't know. So that's a big deal. So if somebody wants to get rid of an unwanted weapon, that's a big deal right there. The other thing is we know that there are a lot of accidents at home, too. And so if somebody wants to get rid of an unwanted gun and this helps them do that, we think it's useful. Now, no one thing is going to change this. I mean, I look at where we were last year. At the beginning of last year, in the first 5 months of the year, we had 22 murders in the first 5 months, which is almost as many as the year before. Now, Seattle is, compared to other cities, very safe. Our murder rate is very low compared to other cities. But for this city to have 22 in 5 months was shocking. And we went to work and we did a number of different things. We got more violence emphasis patrols out. We partnered with the community to try to get the word out to help with that. The federal government partnered on stiffer crimes for gun violations. We had gun stings where we went out and bought guns on the black market and then arrested people who were selling them to us. And the next 7 months of the year, we had a total of 4 murders. So now which one of those things, that's what I would say, which one of those things led to 22 to 4? I can't tell you. And I think the same thing is true moving forward. What one thing was going to solve gun violence? Well, I can tell you no one thing is going to solve gun violence. It's going to be a wide variety of things. And this is where I think it, but the biggest thing I think that changes it is changing attitudes towards gun ownership and use, storage, care, et cetera. And that I think is where the gun buyback is very valuable because it becomes an expression of a city's values. What do we care about? What's important? And by using the role of my office to raise dollars, to publicize what I just publicized to you, guns stolen out of homes, guns not properly secured, we can make a difference. That helps. It's one of the things I think that's good. And, you know, I had every past mayor supporting me on this one, too, and several of them standing with me at the announcement.
Mike McGinn, mayor of Seattle, is with us. And just the last question about the future gun buyback, which will be sometime this summer, which is in the coming 3 or 4 months. In January, one thing besides the outpouring of guns that showed up in a very short amount of time was that there were sort of a lineup of other folks vying to buy
those guns.
So
yeah,
how are you going to organize it so that doesn't happen?
Well, we're going to look at how we, you know, the site and how we organize the site and what we can do to try to prevent that from happening. Obviously, this is the whole thing, right? I mean, talk about gun culture. There were people who were offended that guns were going to be destroyed, right? Seriously, they were actually offended by it. Like they had to rescue the guns. So there's an oddness to our feelings towards guns in this country. And I think Seattle, we can make a difference on that.
Mike McGinn is with us. We're going to take a quick break and come back. Our phone number, 206-543-KUOW, or email weekday@kuow.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, recognizing people have a choice about where they're treated for cancer. At SCCA, doctors from Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, UW Medicine, and Seattle Children's unite to turn cancer patients into cancer survivors. More at seattlecca.org.
39 states allow drunk driving checkpoints, but not Washington State. It's because of our state's constitution. Later today, we're going to learn more about how and why the state constitution disallows DUI checkpoints, and what, if any, legislative options there might be for making a change. That's today during the noon hour on KUOW.
Join KUOW for the 42nd Annual Northwest Folklife Festival, May 24th through 27th at Seattle Center. In addition to music and dance, this year's festival includes a special program about the history and folklore of working in Washington State. Find out more on our events page at KUOW.org.
It's cloudy and 57 degrees in Seattle. Expecting clouds all day. It's going to be breezy with showers, possibly some thunderstorms this afternoon, and a high of 61. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:17.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. This is Weekday, and I'm talking with Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn. On Friday, Chris Hansen announced that his group was adding another $75 million to the offer for the Sacramento Kings. In addition to that $75 million, Hansen says he's going to put in more than $115 million in what are called relocation costs, money that's going to be split between the NBA owners, as I understand it. And then the Maloof family, which owns the Kings, says it refuses to sell to the other prospective ownership group anyways, and even if the deal isn't approved, it's going to sell Chris Hansen a 20% share of the team if it stays in Sacramento. Your office, Mayor McGinn, issued a one sentence like, well, okay, good. But what does this all mean?
I think we're all going to find out this week. Our understanding is today that there's a conference call involving the Relocation and Finance Committee, the same people that looked at it earlier. We understand the NBA Board of Governors is going to be meeting
on Wednesday
later this week. So what does it all mean? I guess we're all waiting for the owners to tell us what it all means. I think it's really clear. Chris Hansen and Steve Ballmer want a team, and they've increased their offer. People are waiting to see how Sacramento responds and how the owners respond to all of this. And, you know, our job has been to be in a position to host an NBA team should Chris Hansen and Steve Ballmer acquire one, and we still stand ready to go.
So this extra money doesn't come out of the citizens' pockets?
No. In fact, any money we put into the deal right now comes back to us. We get repaid with interest, plus we're going to end up owning the arena and the land at the end of the deal. So we wrote a deal that protects our city budget and does not involve us putting any of our own programs at risk.
So then this, whether we get the Kings or somebody else or an expansion team or whatever, this arena redevelopment plan is just sort of going ahead.
Yeah. So the way the arena redevelopment plan works is that we've entered into a memorandum of understanding with Chris Hansen, the city of Seattle, and King County have. Mm-hmm. And we're now going through the environmental review, identifying mitigation, and understanding the benefits of this site versus other sites. And then at the end of the day, at the same time, Chris Hansen is moving to get his permits complete. But we're not going to build an arena unless Chris Hansen has a team. So his goal is to get to a point where he has an arena that has permits, you know, a design that's ready to break ground. But we don't break ground. We don't command any city funds. Again, those funds will be repaid until we have a team.
Last week, a Seattle Times columnist floated the idea of building an arena on the site of Memorial Stadium, which is at the Seattle Center, which I understand that the school district owns but wants to sell back to the city. And she put that to Chris Hansen, who said for a number of reasons it was a bad idea. But it got me to thinking about redevelopment at Seattle Center, the status of Memorial Stadium, and the various industrial, maritime, and other industrial groups that are opposed to the Soto site. First of all, Memorial Stadium, is that even feasible for a basketball team? They could play in the Key Arena, then you build them a stadium and then just knock down Key Arena?
Nobody has really looked at that as a potential. We did early on look at, you know, what it would take to use the Key Arena as a rebuild or even rebuild on the site, you know, with the footprint of the site. That has some pretty significant transportation challenges, too, as well, as we all know. And one of the things we've heard from Hansen is that he likes the Soto Arena sure. because of its access to light rail, because of the direct freeway connections.
90,
a
yeah.
lot of reasons why. And, you know, that light rail, it's going to go out to the east side. It's going to go further north. It's going to go further south. And there's two stations within walking distance of the arena. So that's why he likes there. A Memorial Stadium that's actually – there was a big, big plan for Seattle Center, as you know.
Yes, where I don't know what the status of that is.
I can update you on
Thank
that.
Thank you.
So one of the pieces, and I'm mentioning this just because I feel good about it, is there was a plan to kind of redo the armory. Now, that we what we did go in, though, and do was a $2 million, $2.5 million cosmetic remodel. I don't know if you've been down there.
Yes, I have. That's the building formerly known as the Center House, in case you haven't been to Seattle
right.
Center.
Right. It's now the Armory. We've rebranded, but it's got great local food vendors.
It does.
And it's really – and what we did mainly was strip away a lot of old stuff, create some new doors, create a new balcony, let a lot more light into it. And it's really been very, very successful. Of course, we have KEXP is fundraising to move into the Northwest rooms. And as part of what they want to do is they want to open it up so that it's not a wall between Lower Queen Anne and the center, which is great. A Memorial Stadium, we have been in discussions with the school district about bringing that back into city, complete city ownership. It's owned by the school district. We sold it to them for $1 so long as they used it as their play field. And doing renovations that would maintain it as a place for Seattle School District sporting events, but at the same time, get rid of the hulking stands and put in something that's more open and more connected to everything else. So we keep pushing ahead with that, and we're hopeful we can work out a deal with the school district because this would be something we could afford to do.
I was going to say the school district doesn't have any money to put into a redevelopment, does it?
No, not at all. But what we've been doing is, I mentioned this, is there was a plan that involved a lot of money and a huge makeover. We don't have, you know, big piles of cash laying around. So what we're going to do is, what we've been trying to do is be strategic about it, partner, and continue to revitalize the center. And I think we've been doing a good job. Key Arena, if it's, you know, how do we repurpose Key Arena will be another big question. With or without a new arena, Key Arena is in a tough competitive situation.
So we have a bunch of arena questions here. Bill says, do you find it odd that the mayor, that Seattle's allowing diversion of $260 million of tax revenues to pay for the arena, but Hansen is putting millions more into buying a team? Why can't he pay his own way?
Well, the deal we made is unprecedented. According to a leading arena critic, it's the, you know, best deal he's ever seen, basically, across the country. And we will get repaid anything we put in. And we will get the benefit of all of that investment in Seattle. It's permanent jobs. There will be labor jobs in the new place. And for the service workers who have jobs in football and baseball, this now means they actually have a year-round job, which is a big deal. It'll mean a lot of construction jobs. It'll mean a lot of visitors to the city as well. So there's a very good return on investment for what we're doing here. There's the direct return on investment. Whatever we put in will be paid back, plus more. And then there's all the rest of the advantages to the city.
Mayor McGinn of Seattle is our guest, as he is. There's going to be a little hiatus because it's election season. So this is his last visit for a few months.
As a non-candidate.
Who knows what's going to happen in the fall. A question that we have was about Chris Hansen, who has come back tough. You know, there's been a lot of in Sacramento. They wanted him to play nice, and he said he was going to hang tough, and he is. But how long do you think realistically he's going to hang tough? For the 5 years?
Great question. You know, I've just been one step at a time on this one from the beginning. You know, when I was running for office, a lot of people came up to me and said, can you get the Sonics back? And that looked like it was a pretty tall order, given that we were in a deep recession. And given that we, you know, again, just like with Seattle Center, we don't have piles of cash lying around. And I know people look at that upfront investment we make, but that was structured such that we get paid back. And it works for us on a cash flow basis as well, right? We can bond against it. And our payments are covered by the rent on the arena and the taxes on the arena, et cetera. So I was not very optimistic, but I was also, I made a commitment that we'd look to see if we could do it. So here we are, 3.5 years later. And if anybody said, would we be here right now, I would have said, I would have been hard. I wouldn't have bet on that. I've been hard pressed to say we'd be right where we are today. So where will we be a week from now or 2 days from now? Where will we be a month from now? I don't know. What I know is we've got a good partnership right now with the county on the new arena. We've got a good arrangement with these with this ownership group, and the deal is intended to last 5 years, and we hope they'll stay persistent.
We're talking with Mike McGinn. A sort of related question has to do, you mentioned jobs, and I know that the maritime industry in particular is worried not about the arena, perhaps the location of it, but more about the character of SoTo, the neighborhood in and of itself, and how do we balance any redevelopment that Chris Hansen and other developers might have in mind with the fact that it is zoned industrial, that industrial land within the city of Seattle is, I don't want to say endangered, but threatened sometimes by adjacent development because those are not necessarily compatible uses.
Well, we do have a thriving maritime sector and a thriving manufacturing sector. And they're slightly different. They're related in a lot of ways. And then there's the port, and the port is somewhat different. The port is about mobility. How do they move their containers through the city to I-90 and I-5? And we've spent a lot of money to make direct connections for them. And we're spending more, too, and we'll keep working with them. For the port and maritime sectors, it is important to take care of them, and they added jobs through the recession, which is great. The arena itself is on land that's zoned for an arena. It was actually passed for that.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So that's why we're even having this discussion. We don't have to rezone the land. It is already zoned for an arena. So, but there is a line, and I have not proposed to move that line. And I've over my 3.5 years, we've worked to support our maritime and industrial sector. We recently passed an upgrade of our Shoreline Management Act, and a lot of our maritime, they're on the shoreline. And you may have noticed this is one of those things that didn't make the news. And that's because we work closely with them to make sure that while we upgraded our water quality, we also protected our boat building and maritime sector.
It is a kind of a tenuous relationship because as a city does gentrify and there's a lot of pressure for that waterfront land for views and recreational purposes, the whole idea of Seattle as a maritime city with a working waterfront is sort of core to an identity.
It is core to an identity. And I just want to say this first is we are really fortunate as a city that we have a thriving maritime sector right next to a thriving downtown, and now we have a very touristy and have had a very touristy waterfront, and it's going to become yet more popular. I mean those old historic piers used to have people loading and unloading on them too, and now we have fish and chip shops and a great wheel there. So cities change over time. But we are, in fact, really fortunate to have all of these things in proximity to each other. And right next to Ballard, what used to be pretty sleepy old Ballard Ave now has fabulous restaurants, more people living there. And right down the block, people are building and repairing boats that go to Alaska. So we have to work harder than other places because we have multiple really good things in our city. And that's what we'll keep doing to try to accommodate those multiple sectors.
I guess it's a good problem to have.
It's a hell of a lot better than, having empty waterfronts and decaying buildings. And we can look at cities around the nation that have this problem. So, we just have to keep working hard to respect and support the places that generate jobs and our identity.
You mentioned the waterfront, and I know the Seattle Historic Waterfront Association filed a legal brief saying that the city wasn't doing enough to help them during the seawall construction project. So if you could just remind us of the status of the construction project, what you have proposed and what these merchants...
Construction, I shouldn't laugh. Construction problems are hard, and they're really hard on adjacent businesses. And we know that with light rail through the valley, building streetcar line through the ID. Mercer Ave has been hard on businesses there. Anywhere we do major construction, it's hard on businesses. It just is. And the seawall is particularly hard because you literally have construction in between the businesses and the and their customers. And so it's a little bit harder there. So our original mitigation plan was to take the summers off, which is a big deal because summers are prime construction season. And the businesses say, well, that's not enough. And they've sued. Ironically enough, if they pursued their lawsuit and succeeded, it could mean delays along for the entire project. So we'll just talking to them and see if we can find a middle ground. But again, big construction jobs have impacts which cannot be completely mitigated.
So as I understand it, right now the it was June, July, and August that construction wasn't going to happen, and this was over 3 years, three summers or two summers?
I think it was three summers.
It's a three-year project, as I understood it. And so you're saying that this—
I'm hesitating.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, they were saying, could you take September off,
right,
too, because we get so much business
right
then. And our challenge right then was that, you know, at that point, now we're looking to extending another year, because if we take that much time off— Now, again, if we litigate for too long, that will set off the start of construction as well. And then that begins to have effects on other portions of the project. Because right now, we're not going to, you know, because it then just begins to affect the timeline for the reconstruction of the street, the tearing down of the viaduct, opening of the tunnel, and other issues.
Well, related to that, Mark on Bainbridge Island wants to know if anything can be done about the traffic exit from the ferry, which I know has been diverted because of things going on. It's a mess, he says. Long waits at red lights when there's no cross traffic, potholes, confused routing. I realize tunnel construction's going on. Will it be like this for the next 10 years? And can something be done to simplify traffic routing?
So that's something we're always looking at. And I think that one of the things that happens is that the WSDOT or SDOT in some instances takes a look at what are the detour routes, how should the signals work, and they make their best estimate of how to deal with it. And then you actually put it in place and you discover, oh, that's not working so well. So, and again, construction has impacts. So on Mercer, for example, we've gone in and added turning lanes, changed signals. We have officers out there in the middle of the day so people don't block the box. So we'll continue to be adaptive. We're also working on, as part of this coming year, something Peter Hahn labeled Access Seattle, and we've stuck with it, which is really taking a look at what can we do with how we optimize our existing network to move vehicles, including getting smart signals, ones that actually sense vehicles on the roadway and then change accordingly. And, you know, there's a capital investment, there's a planning investment required, yeah, and then a capital investment. So it's not something that'll happen right away. But we're putting money in to start that planning and capital investment moving forward, because we are looking at, he said, a decade. Maybe that's a little long, but it's not. You know, we're talking 4, 5, 6 years of a lot of construction impacts in the city.
Well, if I recall, the construction of the bus tunnel downtown disrupted the city for at least 5, 6 years.
I know, but it's pretty nice to have for light rail right now.
Yes, so, it is.
But it was a real hardship on businesses at the time.
Tom says, since tax dollars are being used to fund portions of the arenas and I'm paying for this through my taxes, do I get a tax refund when the city realizes a profit?
Well, if we realize a profit, what it will mean is that we'll just have a little bit more money for everything we need in the city, or who knows, maybe we will have a tax refund. Let's see how much it adds up to when we get there. But but you know, we have over 3 years now. You know, when I took office, we had spent the rainy day fund down by $20 million in the year before I took office, and 2009 ended in the red. And every year since then, we have ended in the black, and we are rebuilding the rainy day fund. And in 2014, it'll be above pre-recession levels. And we did that without any general tax increase. We have the library levy, we have the seawall levy, we have the families and education levy, which the voters all approved. But we have not gone out and imposed some new type of business tax or other tax, and we've maintained services. So we've been very fiscally conservative. I just want to say it's your taxpayer dollars. We've been very fiscally conservative, and we've maintained essential services, maintained human services, and made a lot of cuts in our budget without a general tax increase. So I promise you, I'll keep doing that.
And that was his election campaign. Now we have to ask eight people for their status on taxes. Thanks.
Well, I mean, all I can promise right now, I suppose, is for this budget. It's okay. Up to the public whether okay. I can promise it for future
all right.
budgets.
Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn is here. Switching topics totally, a report that was out yesterday made it seem that Police Guild President Rich O'Neill is backing off total opposition to body cameras for police officers, and SPD is going to equip about a dozen officers with body cams.
We negotiated that in the contract. So we have a pilot program in place, and that was one of the sticking points to getting a final deal with the union.
And when will that actually begin?
I don't know the exact date, but hopefully soon, because I think we have the cameras, and now that we have, you know, we need the deal ratified. The union is,
and that's happening later this month, right?
Yeah, they'll take a vote on it, but hopefully we'll be able to get out and start testing them. I mean, there's some interesting questions here. We look at there are important questions. We look at the value of the camera for, accountability reasons, but there are some privacy reasons, right? Somebody knocks on the door and is permitted into a house and is wearing a body camera. You know, what's the,
right?
You know, do we or do we not want that? So there's some protocols here that do have to be established, and then we have to operate. And then it turns out there's also an issue under state law, which is, you know, you're not allowed to record someone's voice without permission. So we have an exemption for dashboard cams. We don't have an exemption for body-worn cameras.
So does that mean you have to get an exemption for the body cams?
Well, we've asked for the exemption. We haven't gotten it yet. The other thing we could do is you could have the body cam on, and if your dashboard cam is on, you could have the camera on, but not the sound on the body-worn camera. And maybe you can hope that the automobile audio can pick up the sound. So there's some legal and technical difficulties to work through, but to make it work, as well as the privacy concerns.
Well, let's talk about those dashboard cams, because last week we heard that the February shooting of the North Seattle guy who was threatening his father was not captured on any of the dashboard cams of, I believe, eight to 10 cruisers were on the scene. And part of that had to do with where they were parked, but another part was the way that these cameras are activated. They have to be manually activated. So one recommendation I think Merrick Bob sort of floated was the idea that once you put the key in and turn it on, the cameras are activated.
Yeah, so I think what we're looking at is an older technology here, and there's like a booting up time. And if you may remember, if you've heard the 911 call or heard of the 911 call, it was... You know, the officers believed that the individual was about to kill somebody,
mm-hmm.
right? And so they raced to the scene. It's also my understanding, you'll have to double check this, is my understanding that some of the cameras were on, they just weren't pointed.
They were not parked in the right
place. They weren't
place.
Parked in a position to catch it. Right. So this was a pretty significant incident. So we're going to, in terms of the technology, you know, these things come around. You know, you have to upgrade equipment on a regular basis. We're also at a position of looking at the, the laptops, too. Those are kind of old, too. I'm not even sure if laptops, the onboard computers might be the better phrase. So there's some opportunities here to take a look at technology upgrades as we move forward.
Does the city have the money to re-equip all these cruisers? I don't know how many cruisers there are, but it seems hundreds, I would imagine.
Every budget decision carries with it consequences. So... You know, it's a question of prioritization. If this is a priority, or if it's made a priority for us, then we will make the decisions to do that. But again, every budget decision we make has consequences somewhere else in the budget.
So I understand it is somewhat of a priority made by the Justice Department that the idea is that we need to, as a city, monitor the potential for excessive use of force.
We're probably looking at some, you know, one of the things is our, and this is true across city government, by the way, just our IT systems, right? You tend to get legacy systems that don't necessarily talk to each other very well. They get outdated. So there's questions about how we maintain all of our records in the police department And that's something that we are, you know, building in. And so what we've done in our budgeting process, just so you know, what we do is when we start the budget process, we look at if we did everything the same, how much would it cost? And then we take a look at what are the things we think we're going to have to spend money on? And if we're not sure, we just put in a reserve for it. So on the police side, we've put in a budget reserve for that. And there are other places where we have reserves for potential future spending. And then we get the revenue forecast, and then we try to balance the budget. And sometimes we can save money here and there without affecting services. Sometimes we cut. So the issue of upgrading our police department IT, you know, we have some money in reserve, and we'll see how our revenue forecast works. And it's clearly an area that we intend to work on and will work on. But it'll probably be a multi-year, you know, multi-million dollar type of project. And we'll have to do that. But we have a multi-year, multi-million dollar project going on right now. When we discovered we really needed to do something about our data center. We've got a data center that's vulnerable. Last year it was vulnerable to loss of electricity, mm-hmm. which had everything on it. So we're doing a multi-million dollar upgrade of our city data center as well.
And a related police, maybe more philosophical question. Merrick Bobb, who's the court-appointed monitor, went to Seattle City Council last week, I think, just to update them on the progress of the Justice Department's mandated plan. And one thing that he noticed was buy-in from the rank and file really wasn't all the way there yet. And right now we have an interim police chief, Jim Pugel, and I guess a question is, if somebody is acting in that job, he's sort of, by definition, a lame duck, does he have the invested authority to turn the ship?
Yes, he does.
I mean, he has it from you. Does he have it from his you know, department members, the entire police force?
He certainly has it from me. And he's the acting chief is the chief. I've made it very clear to him. That's my expectation for him. And and I think the monitor and the acting chief are getting on well right now. So, which is good. And I believe that Chief Pugel has the respect of the officers as well. So we'll just keep pushing and we'll keep moving ahead. You know, the deal is that the officers, they're union. They're civil service protected. They've seen mayors come and go. They've seen chiefs come and go. So it's hard work, but I think Acting Chief Pugel's the right guy for the job right now.
A lot of people have emailed to tell us that, in fact, those 1992 guns that were bought back were in part of a sculpture by George Sudakawa and his son called Urban Circle Project, and you can find it at the Seattle.org website. So now,
beautiful.
Now we're going to have to look at that. So in case you actually...
I thought that was the case. I just didn't want to say something that didn't turn out to be 100% correct after, you know...
Yeah, after you think all... I would know this fact, right?
But, well, you know, after everybody got so excited about the gun button.
Okay,
gun
so you're just going to watch
just,
your
I'm
words
just gun,
now.
I'm just, right.
Gun-shy.
I'm gun-shy.
So
I hate
to
say it. Yeah.
Somebody else emailed in to say, did you know that you can buy guns with those Amazon cards? That I didn't realize Amazon sold guns. So maybe can you make a little caveat good for everything but buying
we'll,
guns?
We'll talk to Amazon.
And finally, I think the name is Drury, says, it's really good to hear from you, Mayor, about the progress with the Soto plan, but I'm curious as to why the whole concept of landing a professional hockey team has been largely ignored. There are literally thousands of hockey fans in the Puget Sound region. We've been pushing for an NHL team for decades. Why is this not a bigger priority, given all the headaches around the Sacramento Kings?
Well, you know, good question. I think that, and by the way, there are a lot of hockey fans out there that are excited about the prospects of an NHL team. I hear from them.
Isn't that part of the thing? It's a hockey and basketball arena?
So, yes, it is. I think that it's basketball. The basketball first is because that's what Chris Hansen is. That's what he wants. That's what he wants. It's also from the economics of the arena. It's the place that makes the arena work. And what I know is that the way the deal is structured is that if we get the NBA team, the arena will be designed, and the way the MOU is structured is that there'll be an opportunity for an NHL team to come in as well. So I think that the hardest part is getting the NBA team. Once that happens, hopefully we'll see an ownership team emerge and a collaborative relationship arise so that the opportunity for an NHL team will follow after that. So we're not we understand that people out there love the NHL, and it would be great to have both.
Our producer, Jason, emails me to just ask Rich O'Neill's salary, which was being picked up by the city. Where is that?
I believe it's part of the contract. That is part of the contract still.
Okay. Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn, it's a pleasure having you here. And yes, this is
we're done.
We're done because we're going to talk about basketball. You're welcome to stay. Do you want me to ask you one more hard question? I'm wondering, since you're making the University District a technology hub in your new proposal,
we didn't talk about the startup initiative.
Wi-Fi in the U District?
Well, there's that. We're working. We're still waiting to hear from Gigabit Squared on their engineering plans. Their hope is we're going to bring fiber optic to the University District, every home and business, which means people will get, you know, KUOW streaming to their devices,
whether they want it or not,
to their homes. Absolutely. We'll all be better connected. No, the startup initiative is bigger than that, though. We're working with our startup community on helping promote them as well. No, I didn't want one more question. It's just this is our last regular monthly
it
chat.
It is.
You know, until the campaign gets going.
So. And then we'll have you in as candidate, McGinn.
Well, that'll be fun.
Okay. It's always nice to see you.
It's always nice to be here.
This is Weekday on KUOW.